Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Welcome to Teacher Quit Talk. I'm Miss Redacted.
And I'm Mrs. Frazzled. Every week we explore the teacher exodus to find out what, if anything, could get these educators back in the classroom.
We've all had our moments where we thought, what the hell am I doing here? From burnout to bureaucracy to soul-sucking stressors and creative dead ends.
From recognizing when it was time to go to navigating feelings of guilt and regret afterwards, we're here to cut out the gaslighting and get real about what it means to leave teaching.
We've got insights from former teachers from all over the country who have seen it all. So get ready to be disturbed. Join us on Teacher Quit Talk to laugh through the pain of the U.S. education system. We'll see you there.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Дамы и господа, добро пожаловать в Prevail. Это второй сезон нашей борьбы с криминальными сволочами. Ваш ведущий Грег О'Леари.
I'm Greg O'Leary. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. I'd like to thank BetterHelp for supporting Prevail. For 10% off your first month, go to BetterHelp, that's HELP.com/Greg. Start living a better life today. We've got a great show. The author of Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House, Tom Lobianco is here. We talk about all things Mike Pence. Tom has been covering this guy for like a decade, so I don't know what karma he had in his past life that he is now, you know, been doing this whole time. I feel bad for him. I have great sympathy. It was really fun to talk to him. I learned a lot about Mike Pence, and it helped me crystallize my understanding, insofar as it can be crystallized, of what his motivations are and what's going on in that head of his, because my God, he's like a sphinx, right? Tom's been covering him for years. He wrote the book about him. He knows a lot of stuff, and this was a really interesting convo. The other thing going on this week, I just want to say it up front. There's this guy, Durham. Every time I see the word Durham trending on Twitter, my brain goes to the word that comes to mind when I see the word Durham, which is bull. So Durham is a special counsel that was installed by Bill Barr when he was Attorney General. From what I could gather, this was just Barr either trying to appease Trump by having his own special counsel, or, you know, Barr trying to like stir up trouble and throw spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks. But Durham is basically the bizarro Mueller. You know, he's supposed to come out and have all this stuff that's going to happen. But whatever comes out of his report or his filing or whatever, I don't care what it is about Hillary and pings and this and that. Let's not forget the basic facts of the case here, which is that the Trump campaign, members of Trump's circle, people who Trump was working with, right, his foreign policy advisors, his son-in-law, the guy who would become his first attorney general, these people all met with Russian nationals with close ties to the Russian government, a hostile foreign power, during the campaign, after the election, and even after that. So I think this might be a time where they're trying to like turn the tables or project or something. But I mean, come on, Jared Kushner really did go out with Kissinger, who introduced him to Dmitry Symes, and that's how they had that foreign policy speech at the Mayflower Hotel, where Sergei Kislyak, the Russian ambassador to the United States, attended, and Trump was able to meet with him. The Trump Tower meeting really did happen. Jared Kushner was there. Jr. was there, of course. Paul Manafort was there. There were representatives of Putin's government. You know, Natalia Veselnitskaya is a lawyer that works for the guy. I mean, this all happened. Jeff Sessions met with some Russians. Jared Kushner met with the head of a sanctioned Russian bank at the Carlyle Hotel. On and on. And remember, Trump met with Kislyak and that jackal Lavrov, the guy that's right now in the news all the time that you see on the news with the Ukraine stuff, this asshole foreign minister guy, in the Oval Office. He let these enemies into the Oval Office, into the inner sanctum. That's what he did. So I don't care about Hillary and pings and whatever the fuck Durham finds. You know, if it leads somewhere, then it leads somewhere. But let's not forget the fact that this guy, Trump, met with Russians all throughout the campaign. His representatives met with Russians throughout the campaign. And he basically did Putin's bidding for 4 years, including capitulating to him in Helsinki in the most embarrassing way possible. Just a public humiliation. So that's the deal. So when I see Durham, I say bull. That's just me. But that's enough about that. This podcast today is not about Donald Trump. This podcast today is about Donald Trump's vice president, the one, and thankfully the only, Mike Pence. So we're going to be right back with Tom LoBianco.
Could you survive on 70 grand a day? Of course not. Let's face it, in this country, 70 grand a day don't go that far. Not with the freaking inflation. And it's certainly not enough for an organized crime outfit to live on. But to a Jersey wise guy in need, 70 grand a day makes all the difference in the world. Hi, I'm Nunzio Ciccarelli, and I'm asking for your help. My family used to control Essex and Union counties. Now, thanks to the fucking Russians, we can barely make ends meet. You heard that right. These foreigners come here and taking our jobs. So yeah, 70 grand a day, it ain't a lot, but we really need to scratch. So call now, 1-800-70-GOOMBA, and give generously. Make the American mob Italian again. And now, back to the show.
Tom LoBianco, welcome to the Prevail Podcast.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks for having me.
Now, you worked at AP, I think, when I worked at AP, except that you're a journalist and I am not. And then you worked for the Indianapolis Star, and you worked for CNN, and now you work at Business Insider. And you basically have been covering the Indiana State House and Mike Pence for years and years. So the first thing I want to say is, whatever they're paying you, it is not enough. You are underpaid. tell us a little bit about how you wound up on this particular beat. You know, what's your backstory?
Yeah, totally, man. Well, dude, number one, thanks. I didn't realize you were at the AP. Where were you?
I worked in HR. So
no
maybe,
way, man.
Maybe it wasn't the same time. Maybe I was earlier.
It's great.
So yeah,
I love the AP.
It's, yeah, me too. It's great.
Mm-hmm. Journalism boot camp, man. It teaches us all how to do this right. And
other than their ridiculous contempt for the Oxford comma, yeah.
Yeah, I know, right, exactly. And the, you know, there's always like the lag time of the style book and like the lead time of the AP style book, you know, and like, and of course, Twitter gauges all of this for us properly.
So now, are you from Indiana originally, or?
I'm actually from Maryland. I'm from just north of Baltimore. I graduated, oh boy, when did I graduate high school? 2000, so like, I graduated Towson High, 2000. 4 years ahead of Michael Phelps. So that guy is forever beating me in everything and I'll never catch up. But, you know, actually I used to write for the school paper back then. You know, I've been doing writing since, well, forever, I guess, really, you know, high school, college, undergrad, jumped out for a hot minute to go to graduate school. I used to do transportation ridership estimate research for former Governor Michael Dukakis up in Northeastern.
Oh, okay.
And so I could tell you all about these environmental impact statements. I can tell you how people screw around with the environmental impact statements. I can tell you to read your bond rating documents always. If you want to find out how a government's doing, read what Fitch and Moody's have to say. I'm not so sure about Standard & Poor's since they flubbed the recession and their assessments. But generally speaking, the people that hold the bonds are the ones that will give you a pretty grim state of affairs.
Fun times.
It's a great if dry source.
Yeah.
So, yeah, man, you know, I've been reporting. I've been covering politics for a while, I guess two decades, something like that. And I was covering Maryland politics. I was covering the Maryland State House for the AP back in 2011. And they had an opening out in Indiana. And they needed somebody to cover the expected presidential campaign of Mitch Daniels. So back in the heady days of the early in the 2012 primary cycle. And I went out there, and I would say within 3 weeks of me moving to Indianapolis, you know, Mitch was bowed out.
And yeah, I remember that being kind of a little bummed because he seemed like a relatively sane, competent Republican. Yeah.
Yeah, man. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm not sure. This is silliness, but I can't shake the fact that he's not a tall dude, and that's not a knock on him in any sense. He's absolutely, I think he's, I always tell people this, he is the smartest politician I've ever covered. And I think the flip side of that too, is to recognize that his political acumen has always long been better than his policy acumen.
Mm, yeah, yeah.
Right? So, you know, with regards to that, I don't know. The first time I saw him, I was like, well, if you can't compete on a debate stage, I mean, it's, you know, height is one of the drivers of what people look for in presidential, you know, presidential figures. It's, I mean, you know, that and an aquiline nose. I mean, it's, it's silly, but you know what? I mean, look where we are right now. Okay. I mean, if you're trying to apply, I feel like we in the industry always try to apply ration and, like, you know, reason, and, you know, we talk things through, and it's like, guys, there, you know, people really aren't making decisions based on that, you know, for good, bad, or otherwise.
Well, it's like the Warren Harding thing. Like they picked Warren Harding and made him president because he looked so much like somebody who should be the president, even though he was one of the worst presidents we've ever had. God damn, he looked good, you know?
Yeah. Exactly, man. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'll tell you, man, Mitch Daniels is he's a great politician to cover. He gives great quotes, super thoughtful in his answers. You know, I'm not speaking to, you know, whether you agree with his policies or not, or his politics or not, but just really fascinating. I remember at the end of 2012, so, you know, Pence won a squeaker in that election. He beat out John Gregg in that 2012 governor's race by, like, it was like 2.9 points percentage points, or like 2.6 percentage points. It was less than 3 percentage points.
Okay.
I mean, it was let's just put it this way. He only barely beat out Glenn Youngkin's margin of victory. Okay.
Yeah. It was a margin of error victory, is basically.
Exactly. And I just remember sitting, you know, this is back in December of 2012, and I'm at this this conference the local Chamber of Commerce is putting on. And it's, you know, look forward down the road, you know, what's coming for Indiana. And Mitch Daniels is up there giving this incredible talk about water tables in southern Indiana and the coming water use fights that we'll be seeing in the next 3 to 4 decades. And I'm just, like, wrapped with attention. I was like, holy crap, man, this is brilliant. I'm just like, this is fascinating. You know, I feel like I'm, like, listening to, like, you know, Jeff Bingaman or somebody, you know, go on about, you know, energy debates in the Southwest, and it's the governor of Indiana doing it. Yeah. And, you know, we had a little gaggle with him afterwards, and we're asking him some questions. And it just hit me in that moment that I was trading Mitch Daniels to cover Mike Pence, the world's most boring politician. And I was just, like, ready to gouge my eardrums out. I was just
already,
like,
that was, yeah, a lot.
Already. Definitely.
In 2012. Okay. Oh my God. You must, yeah. And here you're still doing this. My goodness. Okay. You poor
thing. Right, exactly. The cosmos has quite the sense of humor, my man. Well, but this is really important. And this is actually, this gets to, I think, you know, our central question, you know, why we're talking right now, right? Which is that Pence does a great job of flying under the radar.
He does.
Right? Like, he's really good at it. And he's tested at it. He's studied at this. He's very good at it. You know, one of my longtime sources from Indiana, when I was writing the book, he made this incredible point. He said, for Mike Pence, boring is his camouflage.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that. It's clear. Yes. Yeah.
And that's why it works, man. You know, look at us, you know, we're laughing at how fucking boring this guy is. I'm sorry. I shouldn't curse.
It's fine. No, you should absolutely. The only people who will be offended by you cursing are members of Mike Pence's family.
Okay. Right.
You mentioned your book. So I want to tell everybody what the book is. It's called Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House. And I read it when it came out. It's very good. I'll link to it in the show notes. I read it a while ago, so I want to go back. I want to talk about how the book came about and all this kind of stuff. So, but you're right. I mean, he's a fascinating figure to me because he's somebody that kind of, you know, what does he want? What is his deal? What does he really hope is going to happen? What drives him to attach his star to this obvious criminal who he must have known was a criminal really early on? And to survive for as long as he did. There's a lot of questions that I have that I'm going to ask, but I don't want to jump ahead of myself. Let's go back. But talk a little bit about the early years of Mike Pence, because I think this is pretty important too. Like one of the things from the book that I remember is we think of him as like evangelical, or I do. But he was not raised that way. He's raised Catholic. And he converted later. Remember that right?
Totally.
Yeah. And it was Karen that got him into it, right? Or was it somebody else?
Yeah. You know what's fascinating about that? I've always found these themes in Pence's career, and I guess this is I should probably apologize for this because I haven't written these into really decent columns or essays or Twitter threads. I probably should now that I think about it, because they're just not compelling, the government's, about to be overthrown and people are trying to hang the vice president. These are the kind of things that are just like, two or three steps below that in terms of excitement, whatnot. I always found this thread in his life when I was doing the book, and I still see it a little bit now too, of people pushing him to do things. Really, he's a guy who gets pushed to do things. It's really fascinating, actually. So 1978. So here, very brief history of Mike Pence. He's born June 1959. His family had relocated from Chicago to Columbus, Indiana, just a couple years earlier. And this is in the 50s. And there's a big push of engineers coming in from all over the country to go take jobs at Cummins Engines engine manufacturing down Columbus. And Arvin, they're doing radios. And I think they did car heaters too. And, there's a big manufacturing boom there in Columbus, Indiana. And Columbus, Indiana too, is a fascinating city. It's a beautiful, beautiful city. This world-class architecture there that was put in by the old town father, the guy who was the chairman of the Cummins, name is J. Irwin Miller. And, the Pences move into this, and the father, Ed Pence, is he's working for this oil company called Keel Brothers Oil Company. He owns a couple of gas stations down there, too. He has a couple of Marathon gas stations down there. And they do great, they're like, they do really well, they move up, they start in like these, basically these really tiny, like, cinder box, almost condominiums that were there for like the young families when they're moving into Columbus, Indiana. They move up from that to a Rambler. They move from that to like a, I can't remember what the third house was, like a split level. And by the time the father's moving up in this company, they move into a real nice house in Columbus, Indiana. So it's like, it's in a lot of ways, it's kind of like a classic middle class
success story.
Yeah. So, this is the world that Pence grows up in. He's really got like two groups of siblings, right? It's him and his three brothers are born, kind of back to back from like 1956 to 1960, right? Goes Greg, who's in Congress right now, is the oldest, and then Ed Jr., and then Mike Pence, and then Tom Pence. And then about like a dozen years later, they have two more children, Mary Teresa and Annie Pence. And it's kind of like two separate families. So Pence is really the middle child, the way he grows up. And he actually talks about this a little bit in the 1988 campaign. It's pretty fascinating. For anybody else who is a Pence historian or whatever, if you're looking to go real deep on Pence, I would say always look into his 1988 campaign and his 1990 campaign, because he used to give great interviews back then. It was back before he started hiding himself. So, you know, he grows up as like a basically like kind of the misfit almost. He's the middle child. He's the fat kid, as he says. He calls himself a real pumpkin in a pickle patch. You know, so his three brothers are super athletic. Pence will always go through, he periodically goes through these conversions in his life, these big changes in his life. Oh man, where was he? It was St. Columbus, and then he goes to Columbus North High School after that. And he's at Columbus North High School, and he leaves the sophomore year, and he comes back his junior year of high school, having lost, I think it was like 55 pounds.
Oh, wow.
And,
okay.
Yeah. And he said that when he came back to school, people didn't know who the new kid was.
He had what the kids call this now, that's called a glow up. That's what the
really?
Kids call it. Yeah.
No way.
Mike Pence had a glow up. He did. Yeah.
Really?
That's what it's called. Yeah. You can use that. You can use that term. It's a term.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, there's all these like moments of him. And actually, I'll just bring us forward in time here a minute here. I keep on wondering now when he's going to be himself. Mm. I keep on wondering when Mike Pence is going to show up. I do think you saw some of that in the January 6th letter that he wrote. I mean, to me, that felt very, it was very clear and thought out. I do believe the Dan Quayle anecdote. I just don't think it's as powerful as people says it is, because number one, it's Dan Quayle. And, you know, he's awesome. I mean, he's great, right? I mean, he's a former vice president, you know, huge in the conservative movement, you know, decades ago. But
great
also,
golfer.
Yeah. You know, I mean, hugely influential. He's not him in his world. He is not close with Mike Pence. Pence has his own political world. I mean, remember, you know, like every state politics world, the different power centers all have their own orbits. And Quayle is his own orbit. It's its own thing, separate and distinct from Lugar, you know, when he was around, of course. And, you know, separate and distinct from Mitch Daniels, and very separate and distinct from Mike Pence. So I think people read a little bit too much into that. And I think also, too, it's kind of needlessly dismissive of Pence himself, you know?
You mean that he would need help from Dan Quayle to do the right thing? Like, is that what you mean?
Yeah,
or?
I think so. Yeah. At the end of the day. Well, I mean, I don't know, man. I feel this question on the playground with the parents, okay? You know, it's just, you know, DC, suburban DC playgrounds. Here we go. This is like, it's like one step. This is only one step above, like, you know, I was riding in this cab in Manhattan. Okay. And this is what the cabbie told me. All right. And we're like, you know, we're just slightly elevated from that.
It's a hipster coffee shop in LA. And you know,
yeah, exactly. I was French pressing my brew this morning.
That's where all the good stories are. Jacob, we haven't heard from Jacob Wall in a while. Yeah.
Right. Didn't he so try sad. To kill himself? Or was that stage two? I can't remember.
I think he's in trouble. Okay, but you were saying about his conversions, about his many conversions.
Yes.
Stay with that for a second. I'm curious about that, because I want to understand more his character and what he is. You know, like you said, he's impenetrable, and he's created this. He's almost mummified himself in this. You know, tall, attractive, you know, good looking statue. Yep. That's just there to make that pursed face that he makes and to nod beatifically and not to stand for a goddamn thing, unless it's to stand up at a football game and leave because people are kneeling during the national anthem or something, or to leave Hamilton, you know? So when you say conversions, the first conversion is him having his glow up, right? Where he's you know, kind of big guy. And then he comes back and everyone's like, wow, who's this dude? Because he's suddenly tall and good looking and all this stuff, right?
And so, he becomes, yeah, man. Yeah, let's only carry that forward. And thanks for bringing me back on track. I tend to fly off into
space. That's fine. We're going to cover all that. I want to cover it later when we have the full picture. Yeah, yeah.
He comes back and he's popular and he loves it and he relishes it. And he's always been a rule follower, you know, in his career, in his family, in his schooling. Yeah.
Oh, the irony. Sorry. Go ahead. Keep going.
You know what? This is actually what my book agent and I would talk about when we were putting this thing together, the pitch, you know, years ago was that, like, here's a guy who's dry as can be and just boring AF. And like, but the circumstances make the story with this guy, you know, it's just like, you know, every time. And this is long before, hell, this is long before we even knew there would be an impeachment, let alone two. He does that and starts to get a little popular in high school. And, you know, he goes off to a small college in Southern Indiana, down in Madison, Indiana. It's on the Ohio River, kind of in between like Louisville and Cincinnati down there. And he falls in with like the, it's the Vespers group. And he finds it's one of his frat brothers down there is leading the Christian Vespers group. And he's kind of like pulled in by this older frat brother that down there. And they go and he says, you know, he sees him wearing a cross one day. And this is the story that he tells that Pence told this a couple times, that he sees him wearing a cross one day. And he says, well, you know, how do I get to wear that cross? And the brother in a very Pence syntax. So he says, well, you're going to have to wear it in your heart before you can wear it in your neck, around your neck.
That was a good Pence. That was good. Good job. Yeah.
So he goes to the ICFIS Music Festival in Lexington, Kentucky. So I guess this would have been about 1978, I think. Yeah, 78. He graduated 75, then 79, if that's correct. It's late 70s. And he goes and he has his salvation experience. There's an altar call. It's kind of like, the way it was described to me is like hippie Jesus, you know, like tent revival, like, you know, Jesus, it's Woodstock Jesus.
Okay.
And they've got, you know, lots of folk bands playing, Christian, you know, Christian rock bands playing, and he feels this moment. Now, what's fascinating about that, and I think this goes to the reticence of Mike Pence, and I think this goes to, you know, where to me, really, where I see a lot of the humanity of this guy is he doesn't really leave the Catholic Church until 1994. Okay. So from 1978 to 1994. And what happens in between? What happens in between is all the equivocation and the ambivalence that you come to apply to Mike Pence. You know, like this is like we see this reflected constantly. He meets his wife, Karen, in 1983 at St. Thomas Aquinas Church in Indianapolis, which is right across the street from the governor's mansion, which is a Catholic church. So they attend Catholic church together. They get married at the church over in Speedway near the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. The town's called Speedway. It's in the speed. It's next. The Speedway is the center of the town.
Okay.
and there's Speedway gas stations over there too. That was always fun, trying to figure out which of the three you're talking about, you know?
We have Speedway gas stations in New York, too.
Yeah. Do you really?
We do. I went to one 2 days ago, yeah.
Oh, right on. Mm-hmm. Do they advertise the, like, the 64-gallon, 64-ounce soda?
They do. It's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why pay more for a soda? It's just wonderful. Yeah. Speedway, if you'd like to be a sponsor, you know, hit me up. Okay, so they're married in Speedway, Indiana, at the church, the Catholic Church in Speedway, Indiana.
Yeah, and they get married in there. You know, they go through these two runs for Congress, and you know, we should probably circle back on that. But those two runs for Congress, 1988 and 1990, are really huge, hugely influential in terms of him, his development as a politician, as a human, and then. He doesn't really actually start going to an evangelical church, as could the Greenwood Community Church and just south of Indianapolis, until 1994. And the way it happens is really fascinating. The pastor down there, so Karen and their children, the young children, they think by this point they would have had two children, I think, or maybe the third one, Audrey, I think, might have been born by then too. I forget when Audrey was born, but is Michael Jr. and then Charlotte's middle child. 91, 94, I believe. I'm a little rusty on those dates. And Karen has been going to the evangelical community church and just south of Indianapolis with them for a while. And the pastor is always calling on Mike Pence. And Pence, at this point, is kind of developing actually into a radio celebrity. So he does not start out that way, but he kind of builds his following from like 1989 to 1994. And then he gets picked up on a, you know, statewide syndication service.
Rush Limbaugh on decaf is how the show is pitched. Yeah. I think those are his words. I think that was the pitch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, but here's the thing with him, right? I mean, he's very good at like intentional deflection. Again, to the boring is his camouflage. Rush Limbaugh on decaf, I don't think grabs it with this guy. I don't actually, let me say this. There are a couple big gaps of information I have around him. I mean, stuff that I'm just like dying to find out about. And, you know, I am absolutely certain he will not write about in this book, unfortunately, although he should. Mm-hmm. We need to find his radio tapes. We need to find out what that guy was like on the radio in the 90s. I've listened to maybe 3 of his radio shows. Maybe.
And people don't have recordings of these?
Nope.
I'm surprised. That's weird. I wonder if it is it because he's more rational or
I have a lead on where I'll say this. I have a lead on where they are, and I've been tapping at that for many years now. I don't want to like blow myself up. They exist, I believe. Who knows? Right. I mean, this could be like my own white whale, right? You know, I'm like smashing my head against the keyboard trying to find some, you know, terrible radio content from 1995. But I think what you would find if we did see that, I think you would find that he's just always been following where the right is, where the hard right is at any given moment, and emulating what he thinks works. And, you know, with the conversion, he gets pulled into the community church by the pastor, calls him 6 times to get coffee with him. And he keeps on batting him away. He says, no, you know, I don't really want to. The pastor recruits him to run like a Friday men's group, like a prayer group for the church. And it's pretty much it from there for that. But, you know, Pence is very like, you see a lot of resistance around this guy. You see a lot of ambivalence. You see that in his decision-making. It takes him forever to make decisions. And I think, you know, maybe that's part of, you know, I get that. Sometimes I need deadlines in order to perform, okay? Because otherwise I would just procrastinate until I died. All right.
Yeah, like, I think most people are like that to some degree. Yeah.
You know, January 6th turned out to be arguably the most historically significant deadline in Mike Pence's entire life.
That's a great way of framing it, but yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And thank God he did the right thing, because
I know.
Right? Like, I mean, dear God, I was reading that Michael Flynn, the Robert Draper piece on Michael Flynn. They had multiple EOs, executive orders written up on martial law, how to seize the voting machines. Like, I think a lot of us don't get, and I certainly used to not really get this myself. Sorry for the detour, but we're perpetually in a fragile place. You know, we're not walled off from the rest of the world. And the way that coups and, you know, autocratic governments and, you know, things that would likely stop us from doing this, unless we were in prison. I guess if we were in prison together, then we could probably, you know, still do this and just do it through the bars.
Nobody would have the tape, though. We'd have to, it would be like Mike Pence's radio show.
Exactly. That stuff happens. Like, it's not always dramatic, you know. It's not, you know, whatever Fidel Castro and the, you know, troops, you know, coming down from the hills of Cuba, you know, to storm the city. Like, it's like I can't remember her name, but the sociologist who's been real big recently, who she calls it a status coup, and I'm totally blank on her name. But I do think that, like, you know, we need to watch for that, and we still need to watch for that. We need to be vigilant right now, because bad things happen in autocracies.
That's the takeaway. I've been talking about this in my column and on this show since January 6th happened, like the whole history of this. I mean, that people don't realize how close we came that day to losing everything, and what an attack on our democracy it was. I've been calling it the worst attack on our democracy since Booth shot Lincoln. And I don't think it's an exaggeration. I think, you know, you have to go back that far. We've had horrible things happen in the country. Obviously, 9/11 is horrible. Pearl Harbor was horrible. But those were foreign forces attacking us. This was an internal thing. This was a coup attempt or, you know, an attempt by somebody who had been roundly, soundly defeated in the popular vote by 7 million votes, attempting to stay in power, mostly, I think, to keep getting money and avoid prison. So, you know, not because he was like doing a good job or anything. It was just like, shit, if I'm done, how am I going to not get arrested? We got to keep this going, Mike Pence. That's the thing that's so fascinating about Pence. Now, I want to get into like all of this stuff. We have to take a quick break. So we're going to be right back with Tom LoBianco.
You know, we had a lot of snow this week here in upstate New York, and I did not shovel the driveway properly this time. I thought my son was going to do it. He didn't do it. And what happened was it froze a lot. And now I cannot get a foot of snow out of the middle of my driveway. So this is the sort of thing you have to avoid, right? You get your car tuned up because you don't want to have big issues down the road. You get annual checkups so they nip things in the bud. And it's like that with mental health, too. Going to therapy is like that. It's routine maintenance for your mental and emotional wellness to prevent bigger issues down the road, to prevent the mental health equivalent of frozen ice in the driveway of your mind. You know, these are trying times right now, guys. This is, you know, we've been traumatized for the last 5 years, and mental health is really, really, really important. So it's just essential, I think, for everybody to spend a little bit of time and a little bit of money to focus on their mental health. Going to therapy doesn't mean something's wrong with you. It means you're investing in yourself to keep your mind healthy. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist. So you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with your therapist in under 48 hours. Why invest in everything else and not in your mind? This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Prevail listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/Greg. That's BETTERHELP.com/GREG. BetterHelp.
Okay, we're back with Tom LoBianco. Okay, before the break, we were talking about Pence and his conversion and 9/11 and all this stuff. And I have a lot of questions. I want to get, you know, the way that I want to talk about the insurrection and what he did on January 6th. And I want to talk about the impeachment thing, because that's a big question. But before we get to that, quickly, you explain really nicely in your book, again, Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House. You explain very nicely how exactly he came to be vice president instead of Gingrich or Chris Christie. And Paul Manafort was involved, and there was subterfuge involved. There was trickery. So for anyone not familiar, why don't you just tell everybody the story? Because it's good.
Totally. Important, it's so funny. You know, when we published the book a couple of years ago, and I was doing interviews, I used to forget that like not everybody like lived in the weeds, like, you know, like this. And I would start telling the story by saying, well, it was Tuesday. Oh, and then it was Wednesday, and next on Thursday. And so gently someone in the audience would like remind me, like, hey man, like when Tuesday, when? And I was like, oh, right, I'm sorry. Tuesday, July 12th, 2016. So this was 2 weeks. So I'll try to frame it better here. Here we go. 2 weeks in the middle of July that I, you know, really ultimately decided the fate of the country, right? I mean, it said, you know, there are a number of things which could have gone one way or another. Which would have either, you know, guaranteed Trump the White House or kept him out of the White House. You take your pick, right? Comey in October, you know, Hillary Clinton with the email server, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? The WikiLeaks hack. But one of them, which often gets overlooked, is Mike Pence getting pulled on the ticket. And this is that 2 week period from July. It's the middle of July, 2016. And, you know, for a little context here, right, you know, remember what's going on in this moment Trump is more or less the nominee. There's still a kind of like a last-ditch effort underway by this mixture of like the Never Trump Republicans and kind of the Kasich Never Trump Republicans, and the Ted Cruz, what I would call Tea Party movement conservatives. And remember, these are separate and, you know, and distinct from the MAGA, right? This you know, hyper-national nationalist populism that he's seeing. And it looks like, you know, they have a pretty good shot. The opposing forces have a pretty good shot of denying Trump the nomination at the Republican convention in Cleveland. And that the convention is slated to happen July 19th through like the 23rd, 2016. So Mike Pence has been in consideration for a little bit now. And behind the scenes for VP, Chris Christie and Newt Gingrich are the other top contenders in this moment. And Ivanka have kind of, you know, they were not there earlier in the 2016 campaign, but they kind of inserted themselves once it became clear that Trump was going to be the nominee, or more than likely to be the nominee. And one of the things they were doing was they were helping to drive the VP process. I mean, that, you know, it's like, it's Jared Kushner, right? You mean, it's like he inserts himself into everything. So he was very, big on Gingrich. They all thought that Gingrich would mesh very well with Trump. Christie had his own relationship with Trump from over the years. But of course, you know, Kushner didn't like him because he helped put his father away when he was a federal prosecutor. I know, right? Isn't it amazing? Yeah, like, really, you know, amazing. It used to be that like if you got like one criminal story out of your politics beat, like that was astounding. And then you would talk about that for the rest of your life. I'm like, I can't keep up with the criminal stories of this one.
It's really insane. Yeah.
It is. Oh, man. But behind the scenes, Reince Priebus and Paul Manafort have been really pushing Trump on taking Mike Pence. And there's a couple of reasons for that, and they all make sense. I mean, it's number one is Pence brings back those Ted Cruz conservatives. He pulls them back into the fold. So the first thing you're doing is you're functionally putting out the immediate crisis in front of you. You're dealing with that, which is actually securing the nomination. So that's number one. And Manafort himself is very big on this because he's done delegate battles before. He knows how these things work. Priebus and him, now Priebus more so because he's the chairman of the Republican Party, he has a different concern. And they're shared concerns, but you know, Priebus is more driving concern in this moment is that the people that are turned off by Trump, not that they're going to vote for Hillary Clinton. And I think this is something that, you know, we miss a lot and a lot of people kind of miss, you know, they think just because somebody's anti-Trump Republican that they're automatically a Hillary Clinton or a Joe Biden supporter.
Right.
And Priebus knew, and, you know, I guess this is, you know, you could argue how much this is actually panned out based on turnout numbers, but like Priebus knew in the political conventional wisdom that you would absolutely have to, like, you had to have somebody on there with some credentials because the more likely thing is that their voters just stay home. And if they stay home, that's creating a bloodbath up and down the ticket. You know, you're losing the coattails of a presidential nominee. So that was the reason, those two reasons put together, the immediate crisis and the long-term crisis. And, you know, the funny thing is too, is I think in the back of their heads, they both kind of knew that that this could actually carry Trump over the line. You know, one of the things I read about in there, this was a distinction I did not see before I started reporting on it, but I see it all the time now, is this difference in the different groups of evangelicals that vote Republican.
Yeah.
You know, you have the televangelist who, like the Paula Whites of the world and the Falwell Juniors and that kind of like that world of charismatic, you know, whatever you want to call it, you know, quasi-Pentecostal, the folks that believe that Trump is going to help bring Jesus back. Right. That one. That core of evangelicals was already on board with Trump. They've been on board with Trump for a long time. Pence represented Midwestern, suburban, you know, community church evangelicals, the quieter types. They're probably like, you know, probably not so down with gay marriage, but also not, you know, like, you know, screaming about it from the pews. And Pence represented like a different group of evangelicals. And that too was really huge. So in the middle of July, Trump flies out to Indiana and he lands Tuesday, July 12th, and he's going to do a fundraiser with Mike Pence and lands in Indianapolis and the tire pops underneath the right fuselage of the Trump campaign plane. And they don't know what to do exactly. So, you know, Trump and Pence go off and do this fundraiser. They're trying to figure out, like, you know, how, you know, are they going to be able to be mobile or not? You know, they figure out they're going to be stuck in Indianapolis that night. They spend the night there, and Pence arranges for them to come and have breakfast at the governor's mansion for Donald Trump, Eric Trump, the children, Ivanka, and Trump Jr., to meet with him and his family at the governor's mansion the next morning. And which, and there's a really, there's something really critical here, which I think gets lost. And I think this kind of speaks to me at least, you know, why I believe the things that, you know, it's Trump world, right? I mean, Trump world, people lie constantly, like more than usual in politics. So like, but this to me always made the most sense. In this moment, you're 1 week before the nomination in Cleveland. At that moment, July 12th and July 13th, 2016, Mike Pence still had not met Jared Kushner or Ivanka Trump or Donald Trump Jr.
Okay.
And when you go, when you do this, look at some of the other reports about how Mike Pence was selected. And what you see very often is Kellyanne Conway talking about how the Trump family hit it off with the Pence family on the golf course. And that's accurate. But I think, again, it's kind of like the Dan Quayle anecdote. I think people apply too much importance to these anecdotes without seeing the ones that matter. You know, that was that earlier meeting in July 2016 was Melania Trump and Barron Trump, and then Donald Trump and, you know, that part of the family.
Right.
And Melania Trump and Barron Trump were not calling the shots inside. It was the kid, as they say.
Yeah. Okay.
And at that point, they had not met yet. And actually, the way it was supposed to happen was Trump was supposed to fly off to California for a fundraiser with Jeff Sessions. And Pence was actually supposed to fly to New York alone without Trump for a meeting with the Trump children at Trump Tower.
Hmm. So on enemy territory, he had to, he had to come to Sauron's castle by himself.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, and to the point of him not being taken seriously yet by the family.
Mm-hmm.
So this actually, and you know how much Trump thinks about theatrics and stage presence and whatnot. I mean, he's functionally a media figure and he lives in the media world. So this is, you know, the stuff that resonates with him. They've actually pulled Trump onto their home court. I mean, they have now a home court advantage. They have they have this breakfast. One of the things I reported on for the first time in the book is they have a second meeting, Trump and Pence, in the basement, in the bunker of the governor's mansion. And this is kind of where Pence starts to like really play the game. Mm. You know, before now he's kind of been playing it cool. And you're never really entirely sure with Pence, like, you know, how much of this, like when he says, you know, is it what God intended or not? You know, you're never really sure how much of that is him saying he believes it versus how much of it is him hedging, you know, waiting for the right window. And they kind of blur seamlessly together, right? They have him in the basement and Trump gives him the brass tacks talk. He says, he holds up his phone and he says, look, Mike, Chris Christie's calling me right now. He's like, you want this thing? Like, I need killers. I want a killer. You want a killer? Are you going to be a killer? And Pence looks at him and Pence is like, he's like, honestly, I don't need this. He says, I'm going to run for reelection. I'm doing okay. I'm not a killer. That's not who I am. You know, if you need a killer, I will help you find a killer to make America great again. But that's not me. And Trump's like, he's like astounded. He's, you know, gobsmacked by this. And Trump's like, he's like, what are you saying? Like, come on, everyone else wants this. Why don't you want this? And Pence looks at Trump and like, you can almost see this, like this little Irish twinkle in his eye, right? He says, well, I don't know. You and your family are sitting here in my house on my couch. Why don't you tell me why you want me?
Ha! That's the ballsiest thing he's ever done in his life.
It is.
Yeah.
And you know.
Well, second ballsiest, I suppose.
Right. Yes, man. I know. Right. And it works. It works in that moment. So a couple hours later, 6:30 that night, Wednesday, July 13th, they get the phone call from Trump, and Trump says, you know, yes, I'm picking you. They're elated. They start figuring out how they're going to do the announcement in New York the next day. Now, remember, too, and this is why I always talk about the dates around this, too. There's a time crunch for Pence here, which is the time crunch is by Friday, July 15th, just a couple days, 2 days. Pence has to remove his name from the ballot for governor in Indiana in order to be able to legally run for vice president of the United States.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes. This is, we have like a clear deadline. And again, we live on deadlines,
deadlines,
man.
Deadlines.
It's the only way the world works. So Trump goes, you know, Christie calls up Trump the next day, you know, word leaks out. Trump, you know, Christie calls him up. He's like, dude, what the heck? Like, come on. I thought we were doing this thing. And, you know, Trump, who can't, as one of Trump's guys that had been working on the 2016 the vetting process told me, he's like, dude, Trump says yes to everybody. Like he just can't say no. Like he just doesn't know how to. So like,
yeah,
you know,
the Chris last guy told, in the room is the guy that gets the, yeah. And I think everybody.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, impulse control or something. Right. I don't know.
Bizarre.
So Christie calls him up and, you know, Christie's like, come on, dude. And Trump's like, oh, hey, man, don't worry. Nothing's final. Like, you and Mary Pat be ready. Are you guys ready? You be ready. And Christie's like, yeah, just, you know, tell it to us straight, you know, whatever. Come on, man. Like, it's, you know, the convention's next week. All right. And then Trump goes on Greta Van Susteren that night, Thursday night, and says, ah, oh, well, I really haven't made a final decision. Marty Obst and Nick Ayers are the chief political operatives for Mike Pence at this moment. They see this and they're like, what in the living fuck? Like, come on, dude. Like, we literally just flew the Pence family out to New York and we need an answer by noon tomorrow. Like, we need an answer in 18 hours because we are not, because they know how Trump works and they know that they're not going to let the Pences be left hanging here. So, you know, they call up Trump and Manafort. They're out in California. And they're like, okay, look, you know, we just need you to announce publicly that Pence is it, because we need to, you know, we got this whole thing with the filing deadline, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, yeah, yeah, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Look, we're going to do the announcement on Saturday. And they're like, yeah, we can't do that. The deadline is Friday at noon. And they're like, oh yeah, come on, man. Like, you know, you're in. I'm like, don't worry about it. Like, why would you worry about that? It's us.
We would never lie to you. No. Trump has never lied. Yeah, no, so it's all good.
Friday, so the next day, Friday, July 15th, 2016, Matthew Morgan, general counsel to Mike Pence, is sitting outside the Secretary of State's office with the paperwork to remove Pence's name for the ballot and to remove his name from the ballot so they can legally run for VP on the ticket. And they have 1 hour to go, and they still don't have a clear answer from Trump and Manafort. And they call him up again, and they said, look, if you do not say this publicly, we are pulling Mike Pence from your ticket and running him for re-election as governor. And they're like, wow, guys, Bill, wow, that escalated fast. Like, come on. And Trump was like, he's like, well, can I just tweet it? And they're all screaming at him. They're like, yes, fucking tweet it. So at 11 a.m., he fucking tweeted it on July 15th, 2016. Mike Pence is my running mate, you know, announcement to come tomorrow. Tune in, blah, blah, blah. And that's it.
It's a crazy, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, man.
You said, you know, the flat tire of the plane, I think, you know, there's rumblings that Paul Manafort sort of engineered that. You had a good line in the book. You said, whether it was the hand of God or the hand of Paul Manafort, either way, something like that. I'm just saying it wrong, but it was a very good line. It was a very good line.
Thanks, dude.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there he was. And Manafort, again, you know, Manafort's a guy who's working with this Russian intelligence officer, but he's also a guy who in his previous life, and I think 76 during the Gerald Ford thing, did broker conventions. And I think when they brought him in, that was definitely why, or at least that's what everyone thought was the reason. So that's a great story. So now we're going to zip ahead. We're going to zip past that because I want to get to this. And here's the thing I don't understand. And maybe you could help me to understand. Okay. I'm Mike Pence. I'm here.
Oh my.
Mike Pence. Okay. I've been eating Trump's shit for 3 years, whatever. Okay.
Yeah.
Now it's 2020. It's January of 2020, right? Mm. Is that when the first impeachment was? Yeah.
And, yeah, that's right. Yeah, totally. Okay. Oh my God. Yeah.
And I'm Mike Pence. And I have been dealing with this fucking guy for all this time, watching him violate law after law, sitting back in the shadows and just being, you know, basically being Trump's gimp from Pulp Fiction for this entire time. And now Trump is being impeached. And I know, because I am the vice president, that he's fucking guilty of all of these things that they said he does.
Yes.
If Mike Pence at that moment goes and gathers the forces, gets Mitch McConnell, gets Rupert Murdoch, gets them all in a room and says, listen, guys, let's get him out of here. I'll be the president. We have a whole year. We have 11 months to turn the fucking ship around.
Yeah.
He might be president right now. Because what happens after that is Mike Pence is put in charge of the White House Coronavirus Task Force.
Great
where plan. I tweeted out, I said, I wrote on Twitter, this guy has every incentive to do this job really well. Yes. He has learned from his mistake of fucking up the HIV thing in Indiana when he shut down the Planned Parenthoods there was an HIV outbreak, totally avoidable, totally his fault. Maybe he's learned from that mistake and now he can apply what he didn't do then and apply it this time. And of course, as we know, Mike Pence did fuck all and let Jared Kushner and Trump kill 900,000 Americans needlessly. So if Mike Pence had just gathered people together at the impeachment when everyone knew he was guilty. I think even the Republicans knew he was guilty. They were looking for reasons to not do it without. Why didn't he do that? He wanted to be president. He's ambitious. Yeah. He's sat in the shadows the whole time. Why? I have my theories. What's yours?
Oh, man. Yes, dude. This is very central. And this actually really, to me, helps. It's a great codex for understanding Pence himself. Okay, so rewind a little bit, too, because there's a precursor to this. You know, it's the old, I used to get this question all the time, right? It's the will he push Trump off the ledge, right? Yeah. When is Mike Pence going to push Trump off the ledge? It was a big question throughout the first impeachment, was an even bigger question after the attack, the January 6th attack. The first time this really comes up that I see this dynamic comes up is in October 2016 during the Access Hollywood weekend when the tape comes out with Trump, you know, talking about popping Tic Tacs and molesting women. And you're like, this is the first time of like, all right, the Republican Party is worried that this might be an apocalyptic moment for them. And remember that, and I wrote about this a little bit in the book. I actually wrote about it more later for Business Insider. They had a contingency plan in place for Trump, the Republican Party did, their RNC. And they deny it, but I'm confident in the reporting with it. And to me, it also made sense rationally.
Yeah. Why wouldn't they?
Right, exactly. Yeah. You know, the contingency plan, you know, the way you always heard about it was like, you know, on the off chance that the Mark Burnett's, you know, tapes from the Real World or whatever, The Apprentice, comes out and you hear him, you know, you hear Trump dropping all the N-bombs as opposed to Joe Rogan dropping all the N-bombs.
Right,
you know, at the same time. And so that was like the ripcord in case of emergency. And, you know, that tape comes out and it's probably, you know, about as close as you're going to get to actually getting those Mark Burnett tapes. And within 2 hours of this dropping on 4 o'clock on Friday, October 7th, I think. Is that right? No, is that Friday? Yeah, Friday, October 7th, 2016. Within a few hours of that dropping, the Republican Party donors are already calling up Mike Pence's top political aide, Marty Obst, and telling him that they are ready to replace Trump at the top of the ticket. They say they're speaking on behalf of Reince Priebus and that they're ready to replace Trump at the top of the ticket with Pence. He doesn't even have to say anything. This will be about saving the party and he will be the nominee and he'll be greatly positioned to run again in 2020. You know, but we gotta stave off our losses now. And Pence's team, Marty, says no. He says, hell no. And, you know, it's for the same reason there was also an effort to have Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, and Reince Priebus signed a statement, a joint statement, saying that Trump needs to resign from the ticket. Mitch McConnell and his team refused to sign on to that statement. And I think, you know, both of these things, this gets to your question of, you know, why would Pence not push Trump off the ledge? Back then, it was because all you had to do was wait 30 days and the problem took care of itself because Trump would lose. And, you know, under the all the normal laws of politics, the loser walks away, right? They do a John Kerry, you know, like that's the way things are supposed to work, quote unquote.
Right.
So that was rational in that moment. And rationally, they were all thinking, well, you know, they're looking forward. And, you know, Pence also knew that if you do this, you become the traitor to the cause, right? You become the traitor to Donald Trump's MAGA base. And I don't know if they're like, you know, this is before Pizzagate and all that stuff. Although actually, you know, fittingly enough, when was the WikiLeaks released? The same time as Access Hollywood. So it's really starting.
I think Access Hollywood came out 3 hours after WikiLeaks.
But yeah.
Or maybe it was the Russian, no, it was the Russian, the announcement that Russia had was hacking the election. Was that, that's what it was. It was three hours after that.
It's all happening conjointly.
Yeah.
Head spinning. So bring it forward. I'm sorry, very long way of saying this, because bring it forward, right? I mean, remember, they're acting in cold political calculating terms.
Sure. Here. Absolutely.
And to your question of, you know, would Pence push, do what he could to push Trump off the ledge? No. And the answer was always just survival for Pence for that reason. Okay. Because he needs to be able to have at least some of Trump's MAGA nationalist populist base supporting him in order to run successfully himself. You know, back then they were saying, Pence's people were saying, you know, the best thing that can happen is Trump wins two terms and then Pence rides the coattails as like a George H.W. Bush. And then he gets a term in his own right. And I think when you look at it that way, and that's certainly the way I covered, I mean, you know, when I covered Pence in the Trump administration on the campaign trail, that's kind of how I looked at him for the last 5 years up until January 6th. And on January 6th, and, you know, I'm not trying to apply too much, you know, noblesse oblige here, but I mean, he did the right thing. You know, he actually, like, because he knew politically this would probably destroy him with the base, but he did stop it. Like he did stood in the gap.
And it's, this is the thing that's so, and thank you for that, because I think that does explain it. I think I had Amanda Carpenter on Bulwark writer. She sort of said something similar, like, you know, Pence needs that, those votes are so important and you can't win without them. And so it sort of echoes, I forget how she phrased it, but it echoes what she said, which is that he could not afford to alienate the base. Now, what happened to him, his reward for not doing the right thing during the first impeachment and not doing the right thing during the pandemic response, was to have besiegers attacking the Capitol building, trying to fucking kill him and maybe also his family, because he's with his wife and I think his daughter, right, that day. And he is afraid to go into the Secret Service car because he doesn't trust the Secret Service. It's that level of God knows what's happening. We may never find out the real, you know, the real deal, but he's clearly scared. And I will always think that, especially in the context of the weird Grassley announcement that day, that Grassley is the one that's going to preside over the thing. I think they wanted to kill Pence and Pelosi. That would make Grassley the next in line for the presidency should Trump resign and get a pardon. Because I think the whole thing was about Trump. If he couldn't stay in power, somebody pardoning him who would actually do it. Because Pence never gave Trump a pardon. Or no, that scenario never happened. For some reason.
You know, the thing I heard about this, which makes a lot of sense to me, is that from the Democratic side of the world, and I bet it makes sense to me, is that Pence, that they thought that if Pence got in that car, that the most likely thing that would happen is that Trump would have directed the Secret Service to drive him to Camp David and then have him hold up there for 14 days. While they completed the coup, so that Pence couldn't do anything from there.
Or his, yeah, that makes sense.
Or his, for his own security. And then, you know, you say it's under the auspices of, well, Antifa is coming for you. And, you know, Black Lives Matter is coming for you. Mike Pence, we have to keep you here until Chuck Grassley could do his thing. So
it's all. And again, the whole Secret Service bit is, you know, you'll recall on 9/11, George W. Bush is in an airplane. There's no other airplanes in the entire sky. And they keep him high up. Off radar. Nobody knew where he was for hours and hours and hours because of this attack by guys who were literally halfway around the world in a cave with no cell phone. There is a mob of angry people trying to kill the vice president, and Secret Service like, yeah, Trump's fine. He's good. It's all fine. No. So that enough is tells you, you know, all you need to know. So so now I guess he's been walking it back a little bit. You know, in terms of the severity, Pence, I'm talking about Pence again.
Yeah.
You know, in the statements he's made, is that now him trying to court the MAGA voter again and hoping that they forget that he did this thing? I mean,
I have a working theory. And I think, like, I don't know. I mean, maybe this might just be whatever. I think that we're already in the post-Trump universe. I think we're already post-Trump. And that doesn't mean that Trump is gone. It doesn't mean that he disappears. It doesn't even mean that he's not the nominee. But I think that we're already starting to see the adaptation of Trumpism and the kind of the amalgamation, the sort of the synthesizing. And you have different pieces of it, right? You know, you have Ron DeSantis as like the, you know, the this attacker mentality, riding the wave of the coronavirus. You've got people like, Pence, really, right, going back and like pulling back, trying to, you know, claw back the old movement conservatives, Tea Party conservatives, the Christian right, parts of the Christian right, you know, trying to pull that back. So, you know, you do see a fracturing. And I think, you know, I've been watching this for the last year, and I think other people noticed that, you know, Dan Balls at the Washington Post had a really solid column on this probably about like 3 or 4 weeks ago. Trump's numbers have been softening too.
Yes.
You know,
so
there's really like, there's an opening for this. I do think that we are already in a post-Trump universe. And I think that, you know, the other key marker here as well is Glenn Youngkin, right? How did Glenn Youngkin win, right? Functionally, if we are, and I guess this is where my optimism comes in. Functionally, if we are in a working democratic republic, then what the political parties do and what the politicians are doing is based in winning. And the winning message is post-Trump. You know, what worked for Youngkin was, regardless of the actual policies themselves, and it seems like we're still figuring out what those policies are, mm-hmm. kind of learning by the minute. But the politics of it was centrist, functionally. You know, it's soccer moms with Clinton, 1996, right?
You mean centrist, like who he's going after, not the message.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Who he's targeting. He's targeting your voters in your suburbs, which is a good sign, frankly, right? Because that means that, you know, you're not talking about January 6th. You're not, I mean, we should be talking about January 6th because it was an attack on the country. But they don't see that as relitigating it as a successful tactic, which also means too that you're not, again, there's a lot of optimism baked into this, but it also means that you're not pushing around the disinformation around January 6th behind that. So, you know, theoretically. So that's what I mean by post-Trump. Now, if some of these, you know, the Trump-aligned secretaries of state refuse to certify elections in 2 years and refuse to, you know, send the electors to Washington, the slates of the electors, you know, if they refuse to do the normal functioning of this democratic republic, we're in a different world, right? In 2 years, we're in a functionally different place. So, you know, I guess that's my big caveat here, right? My big caveat is that, like, you know, nothing is normal right now, but to the extent, you know, you can hope for something normal, it looks kind of positive, right? Like, it looks like, okay, you know, we're moving past this, you know, this attempted coup. I don't know.
I like being optimistic. We like to be optimistic on the show. Certainly at the, as we tail towards the end of the hour, we definitely like to close on something hopeful. So you did it. You landed the, unlike Rod Rosenstein, you landed the plane. It's good. Good job. So do you think Trump is going to be the nominee? Because Amanda was like, they're not even going to have a primary. She doesn't think the RNC is even going to have a primary.
I don't know, man. You know, I talked to his, you know, I talked to his people periodically about this. And I, you know, I mean, I get varying answers on it. You know, yeah, he definitely wants to. No, his heart's not in it. I do think that, and I don't have any, I mean, it's, I don't have any firm reporting to back this up one way or another, but I do think that, you know, you could end up with a Netanyahu situation where if he is facing serious legal trouble, he might decide that the only way to stave that off is by, you know, recreating himself as the de facto nominee. And I think that's one strategy they're watching right now. But, you know, he's not acting like somebody who's like really hyped up. I mean, he doesn't do rallies as often as he used to. You know, since he has been deplatformed, he doesn't get the attention the way they used to. I've been doing a little bit of reporting around his media operation. I think I might have something coming on that possibly. We'll see.
Okay.
And he just doesn't, I don't know. He doesn't feel like somebody who's locked in, but then at the same time, you know, circumstances might force him to do it. And if he did, I think, yeah, you run the risk of exactly that, of what Carpenter said. You know, I think you run the risk of, all right, you know, stealing the primaries. This whole thing that happened with the RNC, with Ronna McDaniel and David Bossie, I think you still see the Republican Party right now still trying to thread the needle on this. You know, so on the one hand, they say they stop short of complete expulsion of Cheney and Kinzinger, and they slap him with a censure. But look at the mechanism they use. They used a voice vote, which actually stops all the 168 members from having to be on the record taking a side on this. Mm. So they're protecting their own at the same time that, it's walking the line on this. And again, that gives me a little bit of optimism that things are like borderline normal at this moment. So yeah, I don't know. It's really hard to tell. But the flip side of that, and what I see, and I, you know, I kind of talk about this. I've never been one who buys into the Trump is frozen the field. I don't think that's accurate because the field's running. The field's out there doing confabs. Karl Rove, who was a Donald Trump advisor in 2020, is now holding donor soirees for everyone not named Donald Trump. You know. So it's like they did that down in Texas. CPAC is now CPACs. You know, there's like five CPACs a year all over the globe. That's a pro-Trump operation. Pence is out there doing family council things. Mike Pompeo lost 50 pounds. Remarkable. Good for him.
He had a glow up. It's a late glow up.
He's in a late glow up. Oh my God. Where's my late glow up? I want a late glow up.
I think he looked better with the weight, to be honest, but you know, whatever.
He did.
Yeah, whatever works.
So it's not frozen, right? Like, you know, it's very like it's active right now. And I think all those things, again, you know, in politics, right? Watch the actions, right? That's what, you know, that's what tells us more than the words. And people are running, you know, they're out there. Yeah.
I'm rooting for Liz Cheney. I want a functional, sane Republican Party, and I want her to bring it. And the fact that I'm rooting hard for Dick Cheney's kid tells you all you know about this topsy turvy world. But I really do. I feel nothing but admiration for her and what she's done. So, you know. But I think for this cycle, I don't think maybe not yet. I don't know. A lot can happen between now and 2024. Certainly, as we've seen, you know.
I mean,
when stuff ramps up.
I'm waiting for the Kanye, Andrew Yang, Mark Cuban independent party threesome. Okay.
My son loves Kanye, and I'm like, dude, I think Kanye is not doing good things. He's between the Putin stuff and the financial and you know the thing in Georgia where his PR person was like trying to intimidate maybe Ye needs to step away from the politics for a little while if he's allowed to. You know, maybe not a great idea. So
the fact of being famous does not make you great at everything, you know.
Remember when there was the video of him in the Oval Office and they showed him unlocking his iPhone and it was just all zeros?
Oh my God. You can't.
But that's part of his charm. My son is endlessly amused by Kanye. He's like, this is how Kanye is. That's just what he's like, you know.
It's just the easy man. Come on.
Yeah. Okay, so Tom LoBianco, your book is Pied in Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House. Is it in paperback yet?
Yeah, it's in
paperback. Yeah, I have a nice hardcover copy here, but this is a wonderfully written book. If you're interested in Mike Pence, you're on Twitter at what? It's just Tom LoBianco, right?
Yeah, just Tom LoBianco.
Yeah. Yep. And you're writing now for Business Insider.
Well, so I left Business Insider back in August, and I've been freelancing for Yahoo News and Vanity Fair.
Oh, okay. I'm behind the times. I'm behind the times.
Yeah,
so,
man.
Okay. So your stuff is now Yahoo News and Vanity Fair and wherever we see it. You're doing great work. And like I said at the top, man, whatever they're paying you, it's too little to cover these guys. So I'm glad it's not me. thank you for doing the good work with this stuff. And thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Craig. Thank you so much, man.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fassa. Sophia Tereshchenko provided the Russian introduction. Voice talent is provided by Tally Briggs, Signadella, Stephanie St. John, Brett Petticord, Ryan Byrne at History Falls Apart, and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kenai Williams, and everyone else at MSW Media. Please subscribe to the Prevail website with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $5 monthly subscription funds the site and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Don't forget to tip your server. Until next time, we shall prevail.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.